I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In 2011, we elected the youngest councilman in city history at the age of 26. Now with 8 years of experience under his belt, he's hoping to be Kansas City's mayor. Today, a conversation with Councilman Jermaine Reed. We'll find out why he believes he's ready to become mayor and whether he considers his age a disadvantage or benefit against other candidates in the race. Then, concert pianist Alone Goldstein is set to perform Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1 with the Kansas City Symphony. We'll ask him what the challenges and joys are of performing the piece of music long overshadowed by the composer's later concertos. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When Jermaine Reed was elected to the city council in 2011, he was the youngest councilman ever elected in Kansas City history. Now Reed is hoping to parlay his 8 years of experience to election as Kansas City's mayor. During his time in the council, Reed has focused heavily on East Side development and improving the 18th and Vine Jazz District. He's running in a crowded field of a dozen candidates, and Jermaine Reed joins me now for one of our ongoing conversations with candidates for the city's highest office. Welcome. Nice to have you back.
Well, hey, it's always good to be here on Up to Date and getting the latest news about things happening around the city. So good to be with you.
You're an old hand at this radio business. You're just as relaxed as you can be, right? You've been doing this for years.
Well, yeah, as a youngster, I hosted a weekly radio program on another station, Carter Broadcast Group, one of their affiliates. On both the AM dial and also on the FM dial.
You did it with Al Brooks, the well-known crime fighter, councilman, mayor pro tem, everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been my mentor for over 20-plus years, and I credit a lot of my success and to things that I've done throughout the years for him and him taking me along the way. And actually, you hear a funny story.
Yeah.
My first introduction to politics, and you'll appreciate this, is that I'll never forget that day that Mr. Brooks announced his candidacy for city council on the radio. I was about 13 years old. And Mr. Brooks said, I'm running for 6th district at large. And I look forward to talking to folks along the way and sharing my ideas and hearing from you about the things that are important to you. Now, at 13, I turned to Mr. Brooks when we got off there because I was working as a technician. And I said, Mr. Brooks, why aren't you running for number one? You're first in my book. It started my introduction to politics.
And he began to explain to you how districts work and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, he said we have 6 districts and we're divided by the U.S. Census.
There you go.
This is what and how our city is governed, and that's where I live.
That's in the southeast part
of the city. And so I'll never forget that day, and it's always helped fuel my passion for where I'm at today, along with a number of other things. But yeah,
well, Jermaine, I mentioned that you were the youngest person ever elected to the city council. You were elected at age 25. Now you want to be elected mayor at age 34. Some would say you're a young man in a hurry. Why do you think you're ready to be mayor?
No, I wouldn't say that. You know, I think it's important for folks to remember that our rhetoric should match our commitment. As a youngster, I was certainly told many different times that you're the future and you're going to be leading the way. They didn't say that you had to be a certain age to lead the way. Our city charter says that you have to be 25 years old to serve on the city council. And I ran for office to serve on the city council at 25. And it says the same thing for mayor. And so, you know, I have dedicated my life to public service. And I believe that my story is not just unique to me, and it should not be unique to all of us as Kansas Cityans. But my hard work and dedication for this city is the reason why I'm running to put people first and making sure that we do everything that we can to push the issues that are important to Kansas City. Over my 8 years on the city council, I served on the city council, and it certainly has taught me that the government can only do so much to prove the lives of every one of us. And I'm proud of the accomplishments that I've been able to make.
So is your age an asset or a liability?
I think it's an asset. You know, at the end of the day, no one's going to outwork me. And I think that you look at the field, there's other people that are about the same age as well. I think we all should be inspired in our city that people from all sectors of our community want to stand up and serve on school boards, serve on city council, run for mayor, serve on the county legislature, serve at the state position. That's what this is about.
So how far do you want to go in politics? Some might say you get elected mayor and then here comes the presidency.
You know, I would not go that far.
You're not going
there.
Okay.
You know, I never will rule anything out, of course, but, you know, I have been fueled by my passion and spiritual passion to serve. And frankly, I have always just been dedicated to, as my grandmother would say, let the Lord use you. And whatever his will is for your life, let that be your passion and do it. And for me, that's pretty much what I've been able to do, is that I've been able to run for office and do it in a way that is important. And I want to continue to serve. I think that that's what my calling has been on my life. And I want to continue to do that.
Councilman Jermaine Reed, who's a candidate for mayor, is my guest. You know, one of your top achievements is the money you've brought home to your third district on the city's east side. In fact, you say on your website you've brought $300 million in transportation, affordable housing, and business and economic development to the district since 2011. Is that your top achievement?
Well, I would say my top achievement is ensuring that I was able to put people first in every part of the conversation. We have had a lot of things that we've been able to do, from the grocery stores that are along the Prospect Corridor and making sure that we are addressing the food desert in the heart of the city, to the work that, of course, I've been able to do in 18th and Vine and being able to redevelop the work down there, or just the work that we've been able to do along public transportation with the Prospect Max and ensuring that we have a new Prospect Max line that's going to happen. There's been a lot of things, from housing for senior citizens and everything. But I can tell you, as mayor, I think that my record as a city council person really reflects how certainly I will serve as the next mayor of this city. And that's a staunch advocate for the people of this city.
Let's talk about 18th and Vine for a moment, the Jazz District. You've championed that cause for so many years. You helped get a $7 million chunk approved for renovations back in 2016. Now you're stuck on $10 million in funding for the second phase of the project. Where does that stand?
Well, I wouldn't say stuck, because at the end of the year, the city council passed and reaffirmed the second phase for $10 million.
That is going to happen.
It is going to happen, and the council passed it. I don't know the resolution off the top of my head, but that's buried in the mechanics of the day. But it has passed, in terms of ensuring that the city manager could move forward with the redevelopment efforts that have taken place. There have been non-committed community members and along with council members that I've had an opportunity to serve as the chair of the Development Policy Committee. And it's a larger $27.6 million investment to make sure that we're shoring up our assets in 18th and Vine. And so the council has reaffirmed that commitment.
So why is investment in 18th and Vine so critical for the entire city?
Well, good question.
I was hoping
you would ask me that.
A lot of folks think, you know, and you know I'm a big jazz fan.
Yeah,
I've seen you down there
many times.
But a lot of
folks
around town say it's not working.
Well, let me put it to you this way, Steve. This is Kansas City's gift to our city. When you think of jazz in Kansas City, when you think of barbecue in Kansas City, and when you think of what the game of baseball, it all originated in 18th and Vine. And the reality of it is, it's actually the Negro Leagues in 14 months will be celebrating its 100th anniversary in the signing of the Negro Leagues.
We talked about that
right
here.
At the YMCA, which we're renovating. And so it's important that while the city owns most of those assets in the 18th and Vine district, that we are doing everything that we can to protect and preserve the rich history that we have here in our city. And it's a jewel for all of us.
A critic might say jazz was important in the 40s and 50s and 60s in this town. It's not important anymore. People don't like it all that much.
Well, you know what? The reality is that music, baseball, and food, like barbecue, it brings us all together. And so I would always say that it is important for us to do everything that we can to enhance it. And that's what we've been able to do in the district. And I think that folks should try to do everything they can to embrace what we have as a city. You can't travel anywhere in this country, as I was saying earlier, without somebody asking you, where are you from? And then they say 18th and Vine, or they start talking about the great barbecue here in Kansas City. Mm. And so I think it's important that we be able to enhance and protect it.
You know, the challenge here is, if you took $10 million to a vote of the people right now, where should $10 million be spent? And I'm not sure 18th and Vine would win that race right now, Jermaine.
Well, you know, that sort of vote was held a couple of years ago, and it was about the Central City sales tax, about $10 million over the next 10 years. And that is in a geographic area right in the central city of Kansas City to help with a number of things from affordable housing
right.
to transportation options to ensuring that we can help in historic areas or just any type of preservation. And so that question has been asked, and I think that it will continue to be asked. And $10 million is just a drop in the bucket. The issues that we face in our city are a lot larger than that, and I think that we should continue to find a number of ways to make sure that we can do everything that we can throughout this entire city to make sure that all of our neighborhoods and all of our in every area of the city is well taken care of.
What's the second phase, the second $10 million going to do for 18th and Vine? Where's it going?
Well, there's a number of things. And one, it would be doing the shoring up of the Buck O'Neill Education and Resource Center, which is the old YMCA. And
right.
again, that's where
the contract was signed for to create the baseball, the Negro
yes.
Leagues baseball.
Mm-hmm. Correct. But then in addition to that, there are a number of historic preservations, items that are on the table. There is a new fountain that is going to be commissioned that is going to be right at the front of the actual entryway there at 18th and Paseo. Well, there also additionally will be a number of other things from some renderings that we've have put in place from the front of the YMCA. There's going to be overlook that will overlook the actual area.
Right.
But a number of other things. I would encourage folks to visit 18vinekc.com. That's 18vinekc.com. To learn more information. But I want to talk to you about my campaign for mayor. I do think that this is certainly part of that, but I think there's a number of other things that I think are important that the citizens of Kansas City should certainly be aware
like
of.
What?
Well, I think just my platform and the platform of putting people first and ensuring that we are doing everything that we can to support families to ensure that the next generation certainly reaches their full potential. I think that now is the time for us to invest in all areas of our entire city.
Right,
in addition to that,
that
I think that we also should make sure that our government is responsive to the needs of every citizen in our city.
Translate the public policy. What do you want to do to make that happen?
So, and let's start from this angle, is that we have 210 neighborhoods across this entire city. And one of the things that I want to be able to do is to put people first and ensuring that their voices are heard. We talk about a lot of development that in things that are happening from downtown Kansas City. We talk about the major airport project, which I, as the chair of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, have been able to work aggressively on to ensure that that happens. But people are concerned about what's happening at their front door 365 days out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And, if that's just from basic city services, of my trash being picked up on time, or is that how a city hall will work into me, or when is that new development going to come in my community? Or, we have to have a new grocery store in our neighborhood because we live in a food desert. How are we going to be able to address that? And so as mayor, I want to make sure that we're investing in all areas of our community, whether they're making sure that we're focused on downtown or other areas, but making sure that we're discussing greater economic development opportunities for means of people in all neighborhoods in this entire city.
Well, here's one proposal that's on the table that Mayor James might say is exactly what you described. He's proposing an early childhood education sales tax, 0.375. Are you for that? Or what do you think?
Well, I am not for that, and I don't want to get buried in all of the facts. There certainly is another opportunity for us to have those conversations. But I will tell you that I do think that it's a regressive tax, and it's not something that we as a city, there are 14 school districts in the city. This actual tax of 0.375 is actually from the Central City sales tax, which is 0.125. So that would mean that we would end up utilizing the rest of that revenue, and we would not be able to use it for anything else. And I think
we'd be tapped out in terms of sales tax
correct.
Capacity is what you're saying.
Correct. Yeah. And the reality of it is that with the 14 school districts, let's just use Kansas City, for example, they have a mill levy that has not been renewed since 1966. And the school districts themselves are responsible for public education. Now, do I support Public education, absolutely. And I'm someone who has a public education myself, graduate of the Kansas City Public Schools. I understand firsthand if it wasn't for public education and my mom and my family believing in me and me being able to do everything I can, I wouldn't have been able to go off to college and get a college degree, let alone have a master's degree. But I do think that we have to explore better ways to fund pre-K and not this regressive tax that I think is against our low income residents, and put in place accountability to make sure that we're investing and making the investments that certainly are needed and should be made.
You know, I understand your point, but just to reiterate here, the 1/8 cent tax that was passed to boost the East Side also was a sales tax, and you were for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, and that's for economic development. Okay. We're talking about education. One can make the argument that this is an investment on the front end versus the back end. But I think the reality of it is that people want to see investments, as I was talking about as mayor, that I want to make sure that we're able to do. And they want to be able to see it tangibly right now. And so how do we actually address that? And how do we actually make those things happen? I think that that's part of what the 1/8 cent sales tax has been able to do.
So you're suggesting the payoff for early childhood education might be 20 years.
Yeah.
Governor Parson has pointed to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a little too long for that amount of money right now.
Well, let's put it this way. You go to elementary school from, what, kindergarten to 12th grade? So that's nearly how many years, right?
Yeah.
And so that it becomes a little bit difficult to measure. But when you start talking about economic development, or when you start talking about incentives, and you start talking about the type of development that should happen in your community, you don't want to be studied. You don't want to be taxed. You don't want to be doing something that you can't necessarily see right off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that people want to be able to see this type of investment right now. And I think there's other ways that we can actually fund it instead of taking from the economic development sales tax that we have in front of us.
Councilman Jermaine Reed is my guest. How about the affordable housing crunch? What needs to happen to address that?
Well, you know, for me, I can tell you that growing up here in the urban core, my mom who raised my brothers and I.
You knew some homelessness in your life, didn't you?
We were homeless. Actually, we're here in Midtown, Kansas City, broadcasting live here from Up to Date on KCUR right now, 89.3.
Very good. My job, don't you?
Hey, man, I'll probably do a better job than you, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah, no argument here.
You know what?
I'll and make lots this of listeners would agree with you.
Yeah. I'll make this deal with you. Whenever you need me to sit in, I'd love to do
You'll
it.
You'll do it. Okay.
But no, we, in all seriousness, my family, we did live at Community Link, which is up the street here on Truce from where we're broadcasting live from. And my mom, she raised my brothers and I to make sure that we would escape poverty here in Kansas City. But also, she taught us a number of values that many of my elders in this community also have taught me. And it's translated into hard work for all of us to get ahead, my brothers and everyone in the city. And so when we start talking about this, this is not just a buzzword for me. Folks, you know, can go and act as if that we've got to do some great exercise here or there. But I can tell you firsthand that I know how it is to be with your family and all your items, you know, on the curve, and you've been evicted from your house. And the discussion about how affordable housing is really coming to the forefront in our city is really an important one, because it really does have a real impact on the hardworking families across the city. And I want to be able to, just like Martin Luther King said in one of his speeches, the fierce urgency of now, I want to help bring a new urgency to this issue so that we can achieve with our values in affordable housing, not just by providing supplies, but also making sure that we provide the wraparound services that residents need, and being able to address the housing stock here to support investment that they need in fighting chances.
But how are you going to finance it? There's talk the city needs a $75 million housing trust fund. there's no idea where that money's going to come from. Yeah. How do you get it done, Jermaine?
Well, and I actually am supportive of the $75 million trust that has been suggested. Of course, that would be something that we would have to actually go out to the voters to determine whether or not if that's something that they actually agree with. But
I mean, in terms of a tax increase to help fund that $75 million trust fund?
Correct. That's a good way to put it. And so there are a number of ways that we have to be able to do it. I don't come with the silver bullet to say, hey, this is the way to actually tackle that. We have been working really, really hard to figure out these issues at this point. And I think that prior to the actual election, I still have a job to do as a councilperson. And I want to be supportive to address this issue, just like many of my peers who are on the council now, that we can really put in place some of the things that need to happen. We've seen a lot of reductions from the federal government as it relates to CDBG, community development block grant funding, and other areas. But people want real relief now, and we've got to be able to put people first to make these things happen.
Let's turn to a different issue. How do you slow down all the violence that has so sharply impacted your third district? What's your game plan?
Well, let me talk to you about it from a personal standpoint again, because I have, as you referenced earlier in our conversation about Alvin Brooks, you know, I've worked on the front lines at the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, serving as an interim executive director, and then also with the number of grieving families who have lost a loved one due to crime and violence. And so for me, this isn't just an exercise, but I know that this is something that all of us really in this community should be concerned about. And there, unfortunately, isn't a one-size-fit-all approach, but this does actually need a very holistic approach to providing folks with opportunities to make sure that crime is not just economically desirable life, but something that we can be able to do to make sure that we're integrating our policies with the police department and actually ensuring that we're working to shore up some of the programs like KC Nova or shore up some programs like Aim for Peace.
Meaning those programs need more money?
They definitely need a little more resources, but we also have got to be able to address them in other areas of the city, because while it's targeted in certain areas, we have to have a holistic approach. One of the things that
that holistic approach has been going on for years in this town. You mentioned KC Nova, wraparound services. Those attempts have been made. The crime rate isn't going anywhere. It's staying pretty high.
Yeah. And again, I think that we have to ensure that we are reducing that crime rate, because the reality of it is that they're not just numbers on the table, on the piece of paper or on this table or wherever. These are real lives that we're talking about. And these are real family members who have been affected. You know, a mother whose child is no longer with us, a grandmother whose grandchild is not with us.
Would you promise the citizens of this community that you would not seek reelection as mayor unless that violent crime rate drops? Are you that committed to it?
I haven't thought about it that far, Steve, but sure. You know, I think that we have to be able to make that level of being intentional about addressing this issue. And it has been my life work to address this issue. And I know that there are a number of things to be able to do, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that this is the only issue that we have to address. It is one of the major issues that has to be discussed in terms of being sure that we could put a dent into violent crimes in the city.
No. To be blunt, I'm not hearing anything new here when it comes to how we should approach this. And in fairness to you, I'm not sure there is anything new that can be done. I want to put both those out there. But a lot of residents here in this town are looking for answers. They're looking for ways forward. Yeah. And this race for mayor needs to give this city some direction.
Yeah, and I want to help be the leader of the city as the mayor to be able to provide that type of direction. I'll be 100% direct and honest with you as well, if I can.
Sure.
And the reality of it is that I don't come to the table with all the answers. And anybody that does, they probably don't have the answer either.
Right.
and it requires all of us as a city is to be able to put the right people at the table, to put the right people in the room, and ensure that we can have a collective conversation about putting people first to be able to address these issues. And if there's something that I've been able to do as a city council person in this city for the past 8 years, that has been able to bring people together. good, bad, or indifferent in a number of ways.
You know, one solution that oftentimes policymakers turn to in situations like this is more police officers. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue here is that already 75% of the city's general fund goes to police and fire and protective types of services. Does it need to go higher?
Well, I can tell you this right now, the city manager will be releasing a budget. And actually, for clarification, our budget is actually 76%. And it will be 77% when the city manager releases that budget of the actual city budget. So general revenue funds will be 77% in about 2 or 3 weeks. And so do we need more police officers? Yes. But we also need to ensure that we're able to make sure that every area is actually covered from the north to the south to the east to the west in this entire city. We have about 1,200 police officers that are currently on the street.
Right.
The police department has been doing a good job in terms of putting police officers in different beats, as they call them, and making sure that they are some community resource officers that are working directly with our neighborhoods right away.
And they try to put those officers in places where crime occurs. They've tried all kinds of things.
Correct.
And again, the crime rate wouldn't necessarily suggest there's been much dent put in there.
Yeah, but, you know, again, that requires a culture shift and a change. And people want to be able to make sure that there is a real intention, someone that's been intentional about addressing that. And that's the reason why, as mayor, I want to be intentional about addressing these issues so for everyone in our entire city.
Let me just ask you one final point on this.
Sure.
Again, you've been representing this third district for so many years and thinking about this. Why has Kansas City been hit so hard by this crime epidemic? Other cities have wrestled with it, figured out paths forward. Their crime rates have dropped fairly consistently. We can't make that claim despite all this conversation, all this good intention. What is it about Kansas City, our community, that fuels this epidemic?
Well, you know, I don't necessarily subscribe that the answer that I'm going to give you is the right answer. And I don't think that anybody that gives you an answer is the right answer, right? Because there's so many different things that are at play here that we have to be able to address. And the reality of it is that we can do all the blue ribbon commissions that we want. They're not solving the issue. We've got to be able to make sure that people have jobs that they can go to, that they can find different ways to be able to channel their own personal energy and behavior differently. We've got to make sure that our citizens are educated and properly educated in a number of different ways so that they don't have to resort to crime and violence. We've got to make sure that we have transportation options so that people get to and from and live a decent and honest life. And so there's a number of things. And unfortunately, just because we've had people who've chaired these commissions and done these things, it's just been talking points.
Yep.
We've got to have a new sense of urgency about putting people first now and not just having a talking point about addressing these issues. And as the mayor of this city, I want to make sure that I'm addressing that.
We're
and it's something
that
all of us need to be responsible for.
We're going to leave it right there. That's Jermaine Reed.
Thank
He's
you.
A councilman for the 3rd District. He's running for Kansas City mayor. Thanks for sharing your views. I appreciate it.
Please visit JermaineReed.com for more information. I'd love to engage, sign up, and let's continue this conversation.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with UMKC Distinguished Visiting Professor Alon Goldstein, who's tackling a 27-minute piece this weekend at the Kauffman Center on piano. We're going to find out how he's approaching it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Kevin Wilmot was nominated this morning for an Academy Award for his adaptation of Ron Stallings' memoir, Black Klansman. Ron and Kevin were on the program just this last week. Hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Matthew Quirk is an author of political thrillers. We'll ask him about the challenges of setting a novel in today's Washington, D.C. That shouldn't be too tough. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, those who know classical music know that the thinking surrounding Rachmaninoff's piano concertos have undergone sharp revision in recent years. Once overlooked, the first piano concerto is getting new attention and new fans. That trend is expected to continue in the days to come when UMKC Distinguished Visiting Professor Alon Goldstein tackles the 27-minute piece at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts along with several others. Alon joins me now from WETA in Alexandria, Virginia. Alon, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me. That's great.
This piece spans 27 minutes with the orchestra. Why did you want to do that to yourself?
I just heard you talking about the revision of people's perspective of Rachmaninoff and his first concerto. Well, it went its own revision when it was first premiered in 1891, and then Rachmaninoff being unsatisfied with it and revised it to a really quite a large extent in 1917. And I think there's even a third revision, which is what we are playing. So I think it's a beautiful piece. Incidentally, it's actually the first piece I ever played with an orchestra.
Oh, really?
Wow. So it's nice to, you know, close circles and open circles.
So you know it. You have no excuses here, right?
Oh, I'm never looking for excuses. Once you walk on the stage, all the excuses are outside.
How is it for you when you walk on the stage on a night like you'll be performing at the Kauffman Center with the Kansas City Symphony, playing this piece and several others? What's that moment like for you?
It's the moment where all your dedication and hard work and fear and joy and knowledge and experiment, everything comes together to this moment when you actually start. So it's glorious. It's terrifying. It's wonderful. It's frightening. I think wonderful things are made out of contradictions.
It's still terrifying for you at this point in your career.
In a wonderful way.
Terrifying, well, wonderful. Okay.
There is that, element. It's not terrifying in a negative way. It's a terrifying in you being in your more than your utmost, trying more than, you know, normal or just
right.
And there is a fear factor because you're in the presence of greatness and you really want to give it justice.
Hey, how do you even memorize a piece that long and that challenging?
I think every pianist that goes on stage or every musician, if he was out without music, he would say that, you know, that's the first thing he's afraid. But, you know, one of the things that it's important to understand, it's not really about us, it's about the music. And for me, some of the things that help me, if I take myself away from the equation, then why are you worried? It's about the music.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's listen to an excerpt from this piece as played by Sergei Rachmaninoff himself. This is the tail end of the first movement. It's titled Vivace. What we're listening to there is a recording of the composer performing his own concerto. You know, I'm sure, Alon, you've heard that before. Does that recording give you clues as to how you should be performing the piece when you do it this weekend?
That's a wonderful subject. You know, we have a piece of music, and do we need the composer there?
Right.
Or can the piece tell us everything that there is? And I love playing modern music. I love getting together with composers, and it's a fascinating journey because I'm the one now on the stage, and I'm here to serve your piece, or I'm here to serve the piece. But it might be there's a fascinating story with Messiaen and Marta Argerich, and she was playing one of his pieces, and had absolutely no, I don't know, like to use the word respect, but there's no connection between her tempi and the very, very precise, exact tempi that Messiaen said. And someone came to Messiaen afterwards and said, well, you obviously cannot approve her approach. And then he looked and said, listen, Mata Argerich, I approve.
Huh.
So, I mean...
And he approved why?
Because with what she brought onto the table, her force of nature, her understanding and musicality and instinct, how great that you can do it in a different way. With respect and humility, not with the, you know, oh, I'll change it because I feel it's different. No, with trying, with respect, with going through the journey, with your experience. But then you are different. And the reason these pieces are still alive and will always be alive is because there is different. If there was only one way, yeah, which was the composer's way, well, then why perform it again?
So, Alon, why this piece? I mean, what are the challenges and the joys associated with this first concerto of Rachmaninoff's?
The challenges?
Yeah.
I guess, like with every Rachmaninoff concerto, I mean, it's there are so many notes. So you want to really bring the incredible warmth of Russian music, mm-hmm, and on the one hand it's kind of a homage to the Romantic era, but then it also opened the doors to the modern era in the 20th century. There's a lot of back and forth with the orchestra. Just immersing myself in such incredible beauty and romanticism, and there's the element of nostalgia and the element of melancholy, and then there's the element of hope and some folklore, and I mean there's just so, you know, everything we love about Russia.
All that's packed into one piece, and that's just an amazing thing. Just hearing how you described it, your obvious reverence for this music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just another point to mention when we talked about before listening to a composer and having a composer performing his piece. I was working once with a very close friend who passed away a few years ago. His name was Orgad. He was an Israeli composer. And he told me that once you finish a piece, if the piece is good, then it spreads its wing and is liberated from its creator.
Hmm.
It doesn't need the composer anymore. So, and if I need the composer to tell me what he wanted, that's almost like a father kind of is apologizing for the kid.
So
a Rachmaninoff first piano concerto doesn't need the composer anymore. It's a wonderful piece standing on its own, just as great as number 2 and number 3 and the symphonic dances and the Paganini version. These are pieces which are independent of its creator. And I think Rachmaninoff will be the first to say that. And when Horowitz came to Rachmaninoff and asked him about his second sonata and some revisions and what did you mean here and what did you mean there, and Rachmaninoff just told Horowitz, you know, you're such a great musician, make it your own.
Enchanting and Exotic, Firebird, Aladdin, and Rachmaninoff. That's the title of this weekend's program, Friday and Saturday evenings at 8, Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center. More information on the Kansas City Symphony website. And I should point out that Alon is also featured at the free Inside Music Series Masterclass, if you will, at 6:30 Thursday evening. Reservations are encouraged. What happens at a free Inside Music Series Masterclass alone?
Well, we're going to have a couple of students playing. One will play a Mozart sonata and one will play a Mendelssohn concerto. Excuse me. And then I will share my insights, my ideas, you know, the people that I work with. I was very fortunate to work with the legendary Leon Fleischer for many years. So there's a lot of insights that I love to share from his, from the years I spend with him, but you know we're gonna hear the young performers trying their piece, perhaps a movement, and then we'll start to engage and see if we can get sometimes instant results, sometimes results that will need to be, you know, unfolding with time.
Right.
But it's a wonderful back and forth. And then with my wonderful friend, Maestro Michael Stern, we're going to engage in a question and answer.
Ah, I want to ask you about your background, but before we leave the Rachmaninoff, I want to listen to another excerpt from the first piano concerto, and then I want you to describe this part of the piece to us. Again, this is from the third movement. It's Allegro Vivace. Tell us about this part of the music, Alone.
Oh, we heard such contrasting
moods. That's why I picked it, yeah.
At the beginning, I thought, you know, the first thing came to mind is like, don't forget to bring your vodka. It's a wonderful Russian party with colors and different timbres and different instruments, and we're just having a great fun. And then, you know, Grandma comes and we have to go to sleep and she's going to tell us a story about how Grandfather used to go to the war and, you know, and we had to stay here in the cold and it's the winters that last for 9 months and the nearest supermarket is 1,000 miles away. But, you know, once every 3 months we're going to get milk and that you know, the beautiful landscapes of Russia where you have these winters. And I remember when I toured Russia, I had 3 tours there, and you go in the car and it says, you know, St. Petersburg in 1,000 kilometers, then you turn right and then you go to Pskov, another 2,000 kilometers. It's just this endless and endless and endless road with lots of potholes there. And it's very, but you know, it's like, you don't complain because there's no one to complain.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a little more about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Israel and I grew up in Israel. I started to play when I was 7 years old. I was a normal kid, went to a regular school until high school. I went to a high school for fine arts when I was 17 years old, and I played well. But not no break necessarily, breakthrough. So, but I went to a concert of Zubin Mehta conducting young soloists.
Sure.
And I was very envious. And again, I wasn't playing well then, but I wasn't there yet in terms of mindset. And after that concert, I remember I went home and I thought, oh, well, either you go all the way, whatever happens, but at least you know you tried all the way, or just quit it, but don't just go 98%. And the next morning I decided to wake up at 6 a.m. and practice 5 hours, then go play basketball, go see a movie, do whatever, but make sure every day you wake up 6 a.m., 5 hours.
Wow.
And, you know, with short breaks, but net will be 5 hours. And the following year I played with Zubin Mehta.
No kidding. No kidding.
That was
Rachmaninoff. Good for you.
Thank you. Rachmaninoff 1. That was the first time I ever played with an orchestra.
Yeah. I mean, why the piano? I mean, what got you going in that direction?
It was important for my parents that their kids just would learn an instrument as part of growth, as part of their education for your kids. Incidentally, when you go and play in Russia, it's very likely that the whole audience plays piano. Not necessarily professionally, but they all, it's just part of...
They know it, yeah.
Yeah, you speak a language and then you also play piano or play an instrument. It's actually interesting when you play in Russia, they always come, oh yeah, my sister used to work for the maid who works for Rachmaninoff.
Yeah.
And my sister used to know the uncle of Scriabin. And yeah. And I knew, you know, Tchaikovsky, they always have some kind of...
Were your parents musicians? Did they hand it down to you that way?
No. They each do other things. My late grandfather from my mother's side, he was an artist. He was a painter, but he could also play violin, and he could also do Charlie Chaplin acts. He was a Renaissance man.
Hmm.
So, and we were very close. And I have an older brother and younger brother and youngest sister. They all played an instrument. They all went to other fields, and I'm the only person who stayed with it.
You know, I assume a guy like you started playing piano when you were like 4 months old. Am I right?
I'm more 5, 6. I mean, I guess officially 7, but I don't know what is official. No, I just wanted to be like my older brother, and I played, and it was fun, so I continued. And then after making that conscious decision, what was really amazing when I heard that concept, and that kind of in some ways changed my life, was like, whatever I'm going to do, I really don't want to do 98% of it. I want to do 150% of it. And then if I'm nervous or, as I said, maybe terrified, well, at least 120% will be left on stage, but not 98.
So this wasn't your parents demanding it of you. This was a personal decision that you made yourself, which I guess makes all the difference here, right?
I can only vouch for that decision. I don't know the other one. So, yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, the decision to play an instrument, you know, my parents pushed me. It was just important for them, but you know, when I was a teenager and I decided to put all my heart and soul into it, I was mine. And then the fact that the following year I played with Zubin Mehta was almost like a certain calling, saying, well, that's one thing that will happen. And, you know, and ever since, everything I ever did with everything was always 150% every day.
Alon Goldstein is my guest. You studied with the great Leon Fleischer. Tell us about that.
Ooh, well, you know, how much time do we have?
Yes, well, about a minute and a half to be direct.
Studying with Leon Fleischer is something that I'll probably write books about it. Incredible. It's hard to know where to begin. He teaches you to teach yourself.
Mm.
He teaches you to look into the music as if you have X-ray ears. And X-ray eyes. He teaches you that music is made out of physical forces, just like our universe is. We have all the forces around us that we don't see, but they made balance. They create a balance. And he described it in such beautiful, eloquent words, and then he puts his hand on the piano and everything comes together, and you understand. Yes, that's why you listen to music, and if it's fascinating and the pianist is with charisma and it makes sense, then you look at your watch, oh my God, it's been 30 minutes. I thought it's 5 minutes.
Huh.
Because these artists that can really shape time. And so the whole terms of music is a phenomena.
It's interesting. He was a master player and then a master teacher at the same time.
Yeah, it probably, yeah, absolutely.
Which is not, the two don't always go together.
Well, one of the things he said that, or he likes to say that because he couldn't sit and demonstrate at some point, then he had to find the right word to describe what he wanted. And you really see that he spent many, many, many hours and days trying to find the exact word to describe this phenomena that we call music. And what happens there. And then as a teacher, he's trying to give you tools so you can make your own internal dialogue with the music. So I remember before studying with him, I thought, wow, you know, you always need someone to tell you. And then I came to study with Fleischer, and like, you know, suddenly the process of sitting with those black dots on the paper, the notes,
right.
Suddenly, like I'm having this incredible conversation with them, you know.
Mm. Alon Goldstein plays with the Kansas City Symphony this weekend. He'll be playing Rachmaninoff. The concert is titled "Enchanting and Exotic: Firebird, Aladdin, and Rachmaninoff." Friday and Saturday evenings at the Helzberg Hall at the Kaufman. Sunday afternoon at 2:00. Alon, what a pleasure to have you! Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, co-founder of Cerner, Cliff Illig, will be here. He's retired from the health tech company to focus on outside interests, and we'll ask him what those are. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Liz Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.